Forgive me for coming all the way up here, but I think it's probably easier for everyone to see if that is helpful. Now, it'd be a great help if you could keep that passage open, because we're going to look at it together this evening. And I want to start by saying that the Christian message is a message of certain confidence about heaven. That is, since the death and resurrection of Jesus, Christian believers all round the world have spoken boldly about heaven. And we believe that heaven is a guaranteed, certain, future reality. We believe that heaven has already, if you like, been set up by Jesus, and that we Christians will one day be there with him. And we can see that that is what the early Christians believed, because our writer takes it as a reality, assumes it as a reality as he writes. So just have a look at verse 5, the little 5. On the left-hand column there. It is not to angels that he has subjected the world to come about which we're speaking. So do you see his message is about the world to come? Just flick back a page to chapter 1, verse 14, just before the beginning of chapter 2 there. Are not all angels, ministers, and spirits sent to serve those who will inherit, in other words, looking forward to salvation? And the salvation he's talking about is obviously the world to come. Have a look forward to chapter 2, verse 10, just at the end of our reading we've just had. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, so on. And the glory he's speaking about there is heaven, the world to come, the future reality. And we can see that for sure by having a look at chapter 3, verse 1. Therefore, holy brothers who share in the heavenly calling. So do you see that the Christian message is a message of certain confidence about heaven for those who believe in Jesus Christ? And we just need to be clear as we start that we are not talking about grown men with wings, or women for that matter, with wings, clothed in dresses, holding cans of lager, sitting on the clouds playing harps with halos over their heads. We are talking about life lived out forever, in the presence of God, in right relationship with all around us, enjoying all God's blessings of his new creation. We're talking about what the adverts might call, but don't really express properly, the real thing. Only we're saying that it doesn't come through drinking a can of Coca-Cola, but it does come through and only through Jesus Christ. Now, we have to say that all but the most hardened cynics long for such a heavenly existence, free from all that spoils our world. I hope you do. I should think all but the most hardened cynic we know, you would have to be pretty hard not to. What you might call the real thing, the experience of a concrete, lasting reality of pure, unspoiled relationships, in perfect relationship with God our Creator and all around us. No war, no poverty, no hardship, no disharmony. A world where humanity is at peace with God and at peace with itself. Think of Woodrow Wilson. Some of you guys may have heard of him and his League of Nations. That what lay behind that dream. Think of Tony Blair after the last general election. Do you remember this great cry? On May the 1st, 1997, cynicism was defeated. Fear of change was defeated. Fear itself was defeated. Did I not say it would be a battle of hope against fear? On the May the 1st, 1997, fear lost. Hope won. The giving age began. Now, if you don't like the politicians, John Lennon. Imagine all possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may think I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. But you see, just from the sort of snide laughter that we hear around the place, all of us know that in reality, we somehow always fail to pull it off. The real thing that we long for just in reality, it proves to be so elusive. We want to reach out and grasp it and experience it. Occasionally, we think we've got it, like that great and glorious moment back in 1996 where the ball was lifted over Colin Hendry's head and driven with pinpoint accuracy into the back of the Scottish net at Wembley. There was a moment when we thought we got it if we were English. And yet it just seems to slip through our fingers like sand on the beach. Remember the Beach Boys? We'll have fun, fun, fun till our daddy takes the T-Bird away. I think I can use that because there's a 70s revival going on now, so we're allowed to use the Beach Boys. And yet just a few years later, when we all thought we grasped it in the 70s, those of us who were old enough to know that, when we thought we grasped it, we suddenly found that Brian Wilson, one of the key players, was having a nervous breakdown, had a serious narcotics problem, and spent the rest of his life in a psychiatric ward. Even Bill Clinton, one man in the world who you would have thought had come closest to the real thing, the great experience, said this to Monica: "I have an empty life, apart from my work, and it's an obsession." Now, no doubt all of us have experienced this slippery elusiveness of the real thing. We long for it, a world where experience is tangible and lasts, where relationships are solid and stable, where we can enjoy God's creation without it turning sour on us, where we're in right relationship with one another and with our Maker and with our world. We long for it. We try to create it here on earth. We have great experiences. We achieve real progress, and yet the real thing just kind of slips away. And that's no more evident, I would suggest, than in the area of relationships. I don't know if you've seen Richard Branson's new biography. "I can't remember a moment in my life when I have not felt the love of my family. We were a family that would have killed for each other, and we still are. My parents adored each other. And in my childhood, there was barely a cross word between them." It seems that in his childhood, he kind of grasped this reality. And then a couple of chapters later, three chapters later or so, he describes the breakup of his first marriage. "Although when we'd been washed up on the beach, Kristin and I swore that we would stay together forever, our marriage rapidly unraveled once we arrived back in London. We had a wretched conversation in a bar by the quayside. We cried so much that the barkeeper refused to take payment for the ouzo. Christine felt hopelessly torn, but she finally told me she couldn't see how we could live together, and as I watched her walk up the steps away from me and force myself to accept that I lost her, I went back to the bar and the barkeeper poured me another glass of ouzo." You know, I guess relationships are one of the key places, aren't they, where we think we can grasp hold of the real thing. We think we've got it, that heavenly experience, and yet, even there, it seems to drift away from us. And verses 7 and 8 of our reading, I hope you've still got it open there, express something of the frustration and the failure perfectly. "What is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. In putting everything under him, God left nothing that is not subject to him. Yet at present, we do not see everything subject to him." Now, in their original context, these verses are talking about the exalted position of human beings. And yet, says our writer, the real thing just seems to have slipped through our fingers. At present, we don't see everything subject to him. That heavenly reality, that glorious existence, just seems to slip away. And the Christian message is this: though we don't see it yet, the heavenly reality of peace, of reconciled relationships, of a world at one with its Creator and with itself, is guaranteed and certain for Christian people, because it has already been set up by Jesus. And all of us here tonight who submit to and trust in Jesus will be part of it. Jesus Christ, if you like, is the real thing. And we say that with such confidence. You may be saying to yourself, well, how come you say that with such tremendous confidence? We say it with such confidence because of the truth of verse 9. Two reasons given us there as to why we say it. First, Jesus Christ is the real thing because he is currently crowned king in heaven. Secondly, Jesus Christ is the real thing because he definitely defeated death on earth. Do you see it there in verse 9? We see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor. So first then, Jesus Christ is the real thing because he is currently crowned king in heaven. That is, even though we don't currently see everything on earth surrendered to the perfect rule of Jesus, Jesus Christ is nonetheless currently ruling in God's heaven. We can be certain, therefore, of the future reality of heaven because of the present position of Jesus. And our writer has been making this point now since the very beginning of the letter. And I want us just to see that through the four or five verses where he makes it. In chapter 1, verse 5, he tells us that King Jesus is God's son. You are my son. In chapter 1, verse 8, he tells us that God's King Jesus is enthroned forever. Your throne, O God, talking about Jesus, will last forever. In chapter 1, verse 9, he tells us that his rule is just, righteous, and that he hates wickedness. Do you see that? In chapter 1, verse 10, he tells us that God's King Jesus is all-powerful because in the beginning he laid the foundations of the earth. That is, Jesus Christ created heaven and earth. In chapter 1, verse 12, he tells us that Jesus, God's King, will do what? He will roll up creation at the end of time, like you roll up your towel on the beach at the end of a day's sunbathing. In chapter 1, verse 13, he tells us that God's King Jesus is currently seated as God's everlasting ruler on his throne in heaven, waiting for all his enemies to be put under his feet. Now, whatever our politicians might say, our world as it is now has never ever known a rule like that. No earthly ruler has ever been able to establish the real thing because they simply don't have the power to do it. Jesus, says our writer, does. And he will rule with divine power as he crushes all his enemies under his feet. No earthly ruler has ever been able to establish the real thing because they simply do not have the integrity or the knowledge to do it. Jesus, says our writer, does. And he will rule with absolute integrity and perfect divine knowledge. He created everything in the beginning. He's going to roll everything up at the end. And now, as he rules with absolute righteousness. No earthly ruler has ever been able to establish the real thing, because even if they did have the power, the integrity, and the knowledge, they simply don't last. Rulers come and go. Why do us Christians have such supreme confidence in the reality of heaven? Why are we so future-focused, looking forward with purpose and certainty? Because we believe that Jesus is currently crowned king in heaven. But you may be sitting there saying, hold on a second, this is just a little bit of what I think they call a paradigm shift down in the university. I mean, this is, you know, Alice through the looking glass says, I can only believe so many new things before breakfast. I mean, to ask me to believe that Jesus is currently crowned king in heaven, that he is God's ruler, is just a little bit too much on a Sunday evening just before the beginning of a busy week. I mean, I don't know what your view of Jesus is. You may see view Jesus as some kind of gentle, kind, bearded, distant, mythical, mysterious figure of the past, lost in the shrouds of ancient history, a good guy, a kind bloke, a great teacher, an influential figure of history, fine, but divine ruler and Lord, that is just slightly over the top. Well, now that is why it's so very important that our writer gives us his second reason in verse 9, which is the key verse for this whole chapter, as to why we can have confidence that Jesus, God's King, is currently crowned King in heaven. Why can we believe that Jesus is all these things? Well, do you see the little word because in verse 9? He is now crowned with glory and honour because he suffered death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So if you're sitting here saying to yourself, well, this is just too much, let me ask you to look really closely at this second half of verse 9 with me over the next few minutes. We have confidence that Jesus is God's King, currently ruling in heaven, that he has established heaven for his people because he defeated death when he came to earth. So that tells us that the death of Jesus is the key which opens up the whole of the Christian message. It is, if you like, the gateway to reality. So if you want to know and if you want to experience and you want to be clear on the real thing, this is where you begin. Not with the Beach Boys or with Coca-Cola or even with some new relationship or new experience, but with the death of Jesus Christ. And the key to our understanding the death of Jesus Christ lies in one tiny little word right at the end of verse 9. How do you see it there? It's that little word, for. And that little word, for, is so important that the whole of the rest of this chapter, much of the rest of the book to the Hebrews, which we're going to be studying over the next few weeks here, so do come back to hear it, that the whole of the rest of this chapter is dedicated to explaining what it means. But before we go further into the explanation, let me just give you a slight mental break. Well, it's a vague mental break. I want you to think about just a slightly different concept so that I can underline the principle that the writer is making. The principle he's making is this. We can be certain about heaven because Jesus is currently crowned King in heaven. We can be clear that Jesus is currently crowned King in heaven because he definitely defeated death on earth. Now, in AD 66, the Roman general Vespasian, who I'm sure you're all very familiar with, was dispatched to put down a revolt in Israel. And together with his son Titus, he was highly successful, and the history of that particular expedition is very, very vivid indeed. He was so successful that in AD 69 he was proclaimed emperor of Rome and the Roman Empire while he was still in Egypt. He left his son Titus to mop up the siege in Jerusalem, which Titus did, pursuing his task with the most vicious energy imaginable. And he, Vespasian, headed triumphant to Rome, where he was welcomed as conquering hero. Then, in one of the most lavish victory parades ever recorded by any historian, you can read about it in Josephus's History of the Jewish War, if you want, it's gripping stuff, Vespasian and his son Titus were lauded and honoured. And at some stage, Vespasian was proclaimed emperor and ruler of the entire Roman Empire, quite a big area at the time. Vespasian was installed, and in the following years, he toured Egypt, Israel, the ancient Near East, in a grand tour of his empire. Now, it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to realize that all the people of Israel and Egypt were not able to be there in Rome to see the great victory parade. Most of them were dead, actually, by far as the records can tell, but let's not bother about that. If you were one of the few survivors, you couldn't have been there to see the great victory parade or to witness the coronation of Vespasian. You had to wait to experience fully the benefits of his rule and his reign until he came to be amongst you as the crowned king. But if you were those many, many miles away from Rome in Egypt or Israel, you could be sure that Vespasian was crowned king over you, even though you couldn't see it. You could be certain that his rule would one day extend over you, even though you couldn't see it. Why? Well, because he's already been amongst you and destroyed all his enemies vigorously while he walked amongst you. And their bodies and their war machines lay all around you. Now, that is the logic of verses 9 to 18. It's not a perfect illustration, but that is the logic of our verses. We can be confident, says our writer, that Jesus Christ is seated in heaven, that he is crowned king, that he will one day crush all his enemies under his feet, and that he will rule God's eternity with justice and purity forever. Why? Because, verse 9, he suffered death, and he defeated death for everyone. Now that is laid out for us in verses 14 and 15, and this is the last little bit of explanation I want to do. Just have a look down the page to verses 14 and 15. And this explains the victory that Jesus won on our behalf. Since the children, that is, Jesus' people, have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by fear of death. Now the picture here is not hard to get hold of, is it? The picture is of Satan as a jailer. He stands over our lives, and for all our hopes and aspirations, the one thing that is certain is God's judgment over us, resulting in our death. That is the picture of verses 14 and 15. The picture of every single human being who has ever lived, having rebelled against the holy God. Every single human being who has ever lived, deserving God's judgment. And every single human being who has ever lived, having Satan, like a kind of great jailer, standing over us, rattling his keys at us, holding us captive under the judgment of God, demanding that we be judged by God and separated from him forever. And his argument is this: we've chosen to ignore God, we've chosen to reject his rightful rule, and so our hopes of experiencing the real thing in right relationship with God forever have been forfeited. We may long for a future reality of equality, of right relationships, of justice, of peace. But once you and I turn our backs on God and choose to run our life without him, then God will not allow us to experience it. We face his judgment on us, and he will not allow us to realize our dreams and ambitions, because we deserve his just punishment. And the picture of verses 14 and 15 is the picture of Satan standing as jailer, insisting that the punishment be carried out fully. May long to go free, may long for the real thing, may long for a heaven reality, a world of peace. We can imagine all we want, but the punishment must be paid. Now look at that little word "for" in verse 9 that we said was so important. Jesus suffered death so that by God's rich grace and love, he might taste death for everyone. Though sinless, with no rebellion of his own, Jesus came. He lived. In the words of verse 14, he too shared in our humanity. And this great King and eternal ruler, Jesus Christ, God's Son, out of God's vast, rich love and mercy, stood in for you and me on the cross as he was nailed there. He suffered death for, on behalf of us. And on the third day when he rose again, it was as if he was throwing the gates of hell open because he had paid the penalty that you deserve and that I deserve. And Satan could jangle the keys as much as he liked, demanding that we be punished. But Jesus has paid that punishment and thrown the gates of hell open, as it were, so that we can go free. Now, the story is told of an ancient Eastern ruler who had real problems with drug smuggling in his kingdom. He passed a law that anybody found dealing in drugs was to be put to death. Some weeks later, his royal courtiers approached him in a state of nervous apprehension. A drug dealer had been discovered. He'd been captured and he'd been placed under guard. Well, the king was quite clear. The royal law had been passed. The punishment must be paid. There could be no backing out. It was clear cut as far as he was concerned. He had said, that is the law, this must happen. It was at that point that the courtiers summoned up the courage to reveal the ghastly truth that the narcotics criminal was the king's son. Well, now the king had no alternative. It was as if the jailer stood over his son, jangling the keys. The punishment for the crime must be paid. Not to pay it would result in a travesty of justice. How could he just sweep justice to one side? So the king agreed. Except to say that when this particular criminal was punished and put to death, he should be punished with a hood over his head to avoid the shame and the humiliation. Sure enough, the next day the jailer exacted his punishment on the criminal. But when they removed the hood from the head of the executed body, they saw that it was the king's head, not his son. He had given his life for, if you like, on behalf of, in the place of his son. Such was his love and his concern that he stepped in, he took the form. His glory, if you like, was veiled as he put the hood over his head. And he suffered death so that his son might walk free. And the jailer, he could jangle the keys as much as he wanted, but the punishment would be paid. There was nothing more to pay. There could be no second death. Now, all illustrations, of course, are inadequate. But do you see the concept? Jesus Christ, verse 14, shared in our humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and liberate, free, all those for whose life was held in slavery by our fear of death. And as he rose from the dead and broke out of the tomb, which of course the king in the illustration couldn't possibly do because he was only human, as he broke out of the tomb, and as he rose and ascended to heaven and was seated at God's right hand, do you see? It is Jesus' victory parade. And we can know for certain that he is currently crowned king because he definitely defeated death when he died that day on a cross in the first century. Our confidence is based on hard evidence. You can ask me about it in the questions if you want. A large part of the last few verses of chapter 2, chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, are dedicated to our confidence and the factual evidence of the death of Jesus. However much we may long for the real thing, we will never be able to have the real thing without Jesus. God will not allow it. Because unless Jesus has paid the punishment for your rebellion against God, your rebellion demands just dealings. And the jailer, Satan, will stand over you through this life and on into eternity, insisting that the punishment is paid and you are separated from God because of your rebellion. And I am separated from God because of my rebellion. And every human being who has ever lived and rebelled against God pays that punishment. So let me urge you this evening to get in touch with reality. To get in touch with the real thing. Maybe that this is the first time that you've heard this kind of stuff. All this is completely new. Don't just leave it behind. Jesus has definitely defeated death. Stop Take some time to look at the evidence. Come back. Do the Discovering Christianity course. Have a look at the evidence that is there and laid out. But it may be that for you, tonight is an evening where you can say, I know enough to take action. I can see that Jesus definitely defeated death. And I can see, therefore, that he is certainly crowned king in heaven. And I want to ask you and urge you to speak to the person who brought you, to find somebody this evening. Come and see me at the end of the evening. I'll be loitering around down here to find out how you can get in touch with the real thing and have this certainty about heaven for yourself. The Christian message is a message of certain confidence about heaven. Why are we so certain? Because Jesus is certainly crowned king. How do we know he's certainly crowned king? Because he definitely defeated death. Now I think I'm going to hand over to Nigel, and he'll tell us what happens for the next few minutes.
We're going to have a break now for about 20 minutes. There's going to be some drinks available. You can get it if you want a drink. If you go to this far corner here, or to the far corner there, or to the table just across there on my left. I'll leave the choice up to you, but that's where drinks are available. There's something to eat as well. There's going to be some stewards wandering around. They'll have a badge saying steward, and they'll also have a plate of food or cake or something, and you can grab something to eat from them. Now, as we eat and drink, there'll be some more music. There's a chance to jot down a question, if you'd like to ask one, on the card you've got. If you haven't got a pen, a steward will lend you one. If you want more pieces of card, because you've got lots of questions, a steward will give you one. So do fill in questions, and later on William will see about answering them. There will probably be quite a lot of questions, because there are quite a few of us here tonight, and so it would be useful for us to group them together. So could I ask you, rather than sort of handing in your question right at the end of the interval, if you could hand them in straight away, that would help us. And you can hand them in at any of those drink points or to a steward. So fill in your questions, get them to us straight away, that would be great. And we'll meet again in about 20 minutes. I'll call us back together. Thank you. To make a start again. Thank you very much for all the questions you've given us. I've got a stack of them here. William's had a moment to have a glance at them to think of something to say. And we're going to sort of go through questions for the next 15 minutes or so. We'll see how far we get. I'm sorry if we don't answer them all. And then we'll finish the evening, but there's plenty of time to hang around at the end. So, William, let me read the questions out.
It's a bit like David Allen, isn't it, this? Our schools.
So do you remember David Allen?
Yes.
No. Okay, fair enough. It's not like David Allen at all.
Not like David Allen for them, but for you. Right. The two Ronnies. I thought the two Ronnies earlier. but then I was told Mellon
Come
Smith.
On, get on with it.
Anyway,
that.
Here we go. You spoke of the certain hope in heaven that Christians have, but in verses 11 to 12, Hebrews says that heaven will perish, be rolled up and changed. Why? If there will be a new heaven, what's wrong with the current heaven?
Thank you very much. That's very good. I've jotted down a few notes for myself on the back here. It's always nice to have a really tricky one to start with. I think possibly the easiest way to explain it, and there are probably little loopholes around this, but is to say that there are two kind of ways of talking about heaven. There are the new heavens and the new earth. That is the reality of the universe as we see it. And then there's the heavenly reality of existence with God forever. And it's easy to use those terms interchangeably and to talk about the new heavens, the skies, the whole planetary system and that sort of thing, instead of talking about the heavenly reality of life with God. And I think there is an interchangeable way in which those two are used, so that we have the idea of the whole world order as we know it being wrapped up by God and a new world order being started as the new heavens and the new earth are created. And then we have the writer talking about the heavenlies and the heavenly hope, which is referring to that whole new existence.
Thank you.
Does that begin to help?
I think we'll move on because there's so many here. But if you want to pursue things afterwards, do. Now, this person liked what you said. Message clear, delivery excellent. sure William would want to say thank you very much for that.
It means there's a ghastly question just around the corner.
They're just warming up. You did touch on all the evidence that backs it up on a number of occasions. Big question, I know. 5-minute potted version evidence.
Yeah, we've got two here, yeah. I spotted. Can we deal with the evidence for the resurrection first? And I want to say, when you go home, if you can find a Bible anywhere, pick it up and open it 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And if you don't know your way around the Bible, have a look at the index in the beginning and have a look at verses 1 to about verse 18, which begins to line up for us some of the evidence for the resurrection. And I want to say that you'll see there, when you get to it, that Paul tells us that the witnesses are well represented. That is, there are many, many witnesses to the resurrection, indeed. And at the same time, if you're interested in following this up, follow up Luke 24, the last chapter of Luke's Gospel. Follow up John and John 20, and you will see the many different witnesses to the resurrection. So I want to say that they are very well represented. There are numerous witnesses. Somebody, one of these legal blokes, once did a kind of addition, and he said that if every single witness to the resurrection gave evidence for 5 minutes in court, and that evidence was strung out, it would last for 5 weeks. I mean, that's assuming a court sits for 8 hours a day, which I know is fairly unusual, isn't it, in this country? But there we are. It doesn't stretch over the summer recess. So they're well represented. They are reliable. There are a number of points which I think back this up. If you have a look at what these guys stood by. Now, I know this isn't complete evidence in and of itself, but they were prepared to stand up and stick to their story throughout. And you'll have one person in one part of the ancient world and another person in another part of the ancient world and somebody else somewhere else, all sticking by the same story through thick and thin. Now, if you were an eyewitness and you knew that what you thought you saw was actually not true, but it was actually a hoax and not reality, I think you would pretty soon chuck the towel in and you wouldn't get these reliable eyewitnesses. Then they're very good historians. This is under reliability. You read any one of the letters. It's not like they're just sort of thick peasants who kind of concocted it round the campfire. You'll find that one person writing his gospel in one part of the world has the same story as somebody else writing his gospel in the other part of the world. And that they write coherently and well. They're intelligent people. Have a look at 1 Peter. And you'll find that 1 Peter is well argued, it's thoroughly well reasoned, it's thought through, it's coherent, it's logical. You know, these aren't just ignorant peasants like the kind of arrogant late 20th century humanists tend to think of them as and write them off as ignorant peasants. No, they're reliable, reasoned, carefully thinking people. And they all tell the same story, and they're prepared to stick to it through thick and thin. They're well represented, there are many of them, they're reliable. And the third point on that is that they're reformed. And you look at somebody like Paul, who was the greatest enemy of Christianity, went round trying to destroy Christians, putting them to death. And then when he looked at the evidence, thought it through, and Jesus appeared to him, he turned around completely. Look at Thomas. Jesus, he says, I'm not going to believe unless I see him believe. Jesus come, he commands him to believe, and he believes. So they're reformed. They change their point of view. They're committed in one direction, you know, the committed Liverpool supporter. It takes a miracle. So we get them to turn around and go in the opposite direction. Well, they're committed anti-Christian, somebody like Paul. Thomas, unsure, unclear. Jesus appears, they turn around and go in the opposite direction. Now that's just beginning to touch. Then there's all the evidence of the empty tomb. I mean, you have to stop and say to yourself, well, what happened to the body? What do you think they did with the body? If the Romans, I could go on forever, but I'll just laugh. I mean, if really it was all some huge joke, when the Christians came, if the Romans, for example, had nicked the body, when the Christians came along and started proclaiming that Jesus had risen from the dead, what would you have done if you were a Roman soldier? Or if you were the Roman forces? Or if you were the Jews? You know, if you'd nicked the body, you would have said, well, actually, no, here it is. And that would have scotched all of that. Some people say that Jesus sort of revived, sort of kind of came round and then rolled the stone away and then walked around the ancient world convincing his disciples that he really had risen from the dead. But I think by the time if you get to that level, if you believe that, you believe anything, and you'd be better to stick with the reliable, well-represented and reformed eyewitnesses. Now the second one, I'm sorry, this is me rabbiting for a bit, but the second one was a question of the evidence for the New Testament documents. And I think there are a couple of things to say on that. In other words, it's another evidence question. Can we trust
at the New Testament documents. And there are really two questions wrapped up in there. Is what these guys wrote what actually happened? And then do we have what these guys actually wrote? So there were people who were asking about Hebrews, and what we're saying is, are these guys reliable eyewitnesses? And again, when you get home, if you were asking that question, turn up Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, and you will see that Luke has taken great pains to write out carefully exactly what happened. He considers himself to be an historian. And you'll find that the four gospel writers, writing in different parts of the world, tell the same story. And in the days of lack of email and all that sort of thing, checking up and all that sort of kit is not that easy. So you've got the same story, albeit with slight differences, because they're telling it from a slightly different angle, being taught from different areas of the world. And then Paul, writing his letters almost immediately after, very shortly after the death and resurrection of Jesus, he's telling the same story as well. So you've got all these different people telling the same story, and I want to say, well, you've got, again, well-represented, reliable witnesses. Do we have what they wrote? And then it's time for another question. Do we have what they wrote? Well, again, if you know anything about the transmission of these documents, they went through different routes. Now, let me just do a little exercise. We won't do it, but imagine for a moment that Rachel's sitting over there. I whispered something in her ear, and she passed it all the way around until we got to the back over there. I can't see anyone I know. That's very nice. Somebody over there. And if I gave a message down here and we worked all our way around over there, the way to check that we have the originals that started off, assuming it's the same message, is to see whether the two that get back there are basically saying the same thing. Now, the New Testament documents, in their translations, went down different routes. You've got one heading through the kind of Latin translation route. You've got one heading through the Syriac route. You've got the Greek version. And by taking the ones as they go down their different routes and checking and cross-checking across them, we find that they do not disagree in any major detail. There are one or two tiny little manuscript copying issues, but basically they're not disagreeing in any major detail. So I'm wanting to say that what we have seems to be what they wrote, because we seem to be able to check it out like that. Now, come back to me. All these questions we deal with on the Discovering Christianity course, and you know, you'll be free to ask as many questions as you like. But you know, people have looked into these things. We do think about them. We don't just take our heads off and believe anything.
Thank you. Now, let's move on to a different subject. How can justice be done if someone else suffers a punishment for my crime? Surely the point of justice is that I should suffer a reciprocal punishment for what I've done wrong. What does it achieve if someone else suffers the punishment instead? Where's the justice in that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's a key question, and it lies at the heart of the understanding of the incarnation. That is, Jesus becoming fully human whilst being fully God, and it lies at the heart of the cross. That's absolutely right. One person could only ever die for one other person's sin if they were perfect. So it would be utterly unjust. I couldn't die for Nigel's punishment, or take Nigel's place, for example, if I had myself committed some major crime. But if I am perfect, in other words, if Jesus is fully pure and perfect, fully divine, he is able to take the place of somebody else because he is God, and he has not rebelled against God himself. He has been in perfect relationship with God throughout his existence. And as God, he's able to take the place of many, many people. As man, he's able to take the place of human beings. That was at the heart of our passage. He shared our humanity. Because he shared our humanity and became fully man, he is able to stand in place of another human being because he has lived as man. Because he's God on the other side of the equation, and he lives a perfect life, and he never sins, he is the perfect man, and so he is able to step in our place. Because the problem is primarily a problem with God and his anger, God is able to say, I accept this just punishment, because the one being punished is fully human. He shared our humanity. He lived a fully human life. And he is fully divine. Therefore, he lived a perfect life. And lived a perfect life on behalf of every one of his people. Does that begin to tackle it? Is there anything I haven't tackled there?
No, I think...
Play devil's advocate.
No, I think... Let's go on. Because there's some other choice ones here. And I'm afraid... I mean, obviously, we can't deal with questions completely. But there'll be information afterwards about how you can pursue these things more. But this is a good one. Is there such certainty in hell as there is certainty in heaven?
Thank you. I want to say... we would love to see you back here on Tuesday the... What date is Roy coming?
A week on Tuesday.
We're devoting a whole 45 minutes.
The recording ends at this point because the original tape was not sufficiently long to accommodate the whole talk.